So many people are going to go and smell the dogs when they're listening to this.
I mean, in reality, most Santa Cruz owners don't buy just one Santa Cruz and stop there, do they?
Not that I go around smelling Shimano chains all the time.
It might be 200 grams. It's the weight of a wet shoe.
You said field of wheat, not field of weed, right? I don't think they do much of that up there.
Hello, Single Track listeners. Mark here. You join us for another Single Track podcast. This week, I am joined by Chips.
Hello.
And Amanda.
Hello.
And we have a guest this week. We have Anthony de Havingham. He's one of our long-standing contributors. We were trying to work out how to describe him in preamble to this podcast. He's an active trail advocate involved in a number of advocacy projects around the country. Is that right, Anthony?
Yeah, started off with a trail association down in Bristol and now trying to get one up and running for our local area of Calderdale. So, yeah.
Brilliant stuff. So he's going to join us this week to talk about some of the issues and talking points that we've all come armed with.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
The first thing I'm going to bring up is we are in the middle of redesigning the printed mag that's coming out in December. Isn't that right, Amanda?
We are, yes.
How's that going?
It's going well. At this stage, if you asked me 2 weeks ago, I might not have been so positive. I probably wouldn't have been here. I certainly wouldn't have been positive. But yeah, change is good.
Change is good. Chips, you've been involved in this, obviously, because you're our editor at large when it comes to the print magazine. So what's your thoughts on the redesign so far?
It's good. We're basically trying to, distill the essence of the magazine so that there's less kind of flipping through going, oh, what's this feature? I don't know what's going on, and going, right, here's a feature I want to sit down and consume for the next 10 minutes. And I want to pore over the pictures. I want to read all the words, because obviously as the editor, I'm always offended that everyone's like, oh, well, I love the pictures. So it's a case just in terms of content and sort of presentation of trying to distill the magazine down so that it's I don't know, we've turned all the colours up, not literally because that'd be bad, we've just kind of made it so that it's more single track.
Well, that's brilliant. Isn't essence all about how it smells as well? I mean, we have to point out, actually, it's not just a design upgrade, is it, Amanda? We've actually upgraded something else.
We have, but I don't feel I can comment on it yet because I've not had it in my hand yet. We're talking about the paper, right?
We are talking about the paper,
yeah. Yeah, so we've held a blank white sheet copy of what the new paper will be and managed to be excited about that. So with print on it, I'm sure it'll be amazing.
Yeah. We're all excited about it, and we've been, you know, Single Track's been doing this for 22 years, knocking out print, and it's always really, really exciting when a any issue comes out, we're always kind of really excited when it lands on the doorstep and everyone rushes and starts flicking through it and smelling it. I'm interested to know what the new paper's going to smell like. That's going to be the first thing I do.
Yeah,
I open it to the centre and stick my face into it.
The readers miss out on the decision-making parts of you running around the office going, close your eyes and smell that. Put your hand out.
Charlie's really, really keen that we should investigate smell-o-vision. I mean, Chips, do you remember Warner's once offered us that service, didn't they?
They did, but they could only do a limited number of smells. They could do, you know, strawberry or you know, and basically anything where someone has synthesized the smell so much that it was, you know, available by the tanker load. Yes.
It was for the cover, wasn't it? And oh, by the way, Warner's is our printer, by the way, if no one gets that reference. But yeah, we kind of were saying to them, yeah, you've got about 100 smells there. Can you go and do something like WD-40 or something like that, or a smell of rubber? But those weren't on the menu. I don't remember. I'm not sure that would have been that appealing, really, would it?
I've just actually written a column that will appear at some point about smells, just because smell is obviously the sort of strongest trigger sense that we have. And there are some things that whisk me right back to, you know, where I was 30 years ago or something, like opening cardboard boxes with bike components in. They have a particular smell to them.
Shimano chains.
Yes.
They have a unique smell, I find. Not that I go around smelling Shimano chains all the time. Anthony, if there was one smell that you could make our magazine smell of, what do you think would be the most appropriate smell?
Well, I'm pretty sure Pine Fresh has got to be, you know, that lovely sort of pine needle thing. That's got to be a commercially available smell, given its ubiquity in the hygiene industry. Yeah, that plus a nice picture would be nice, as long as it wasn't too lavatorial.
That's the thing. It's a fine line between Alpine Fresh Vistas and cleaning the loo.
I don't agree. Sorry. I think out on the trails and on your bike, you've got all these outdoorsy smells, but the magazine is a baked goods, coffee, bath, bubble bath smell.
I like what? So, blueberry muffin.
Yeah.
We've had two dogs on the cover, and I did think at those times.
No!
Wet dog. Wet dog smell.
No, puppy's paws. I bet popcorn's a popular one, and that's what puppy's paws smell like.
Really?
So many people are going to go True. And smell the dogs when they're listening yeah. to this. Paw, give us a paw.
Right. Well, at this juncture, I'm going to do that thing we do on podcasts, which is going to just break for a moment just to tell you about a bit of promotion that is important to us. This week, Charlie, who's not here, Charlie might be on the podcast next week, so he can probably do this more justice. But I've got Charlie's notes here. Charlie's got a new membership offer. And he says, join us now and beat the price increase, because at the end of this month, the prices of Single Track magazine memberships are actually going up. But if you get in now, you'll lock in your price for the next 12 months at the existing price. So join us now, beat the price increase. And if you use this code, FreeBell04, that's FreeBell04, when you join us as a print or digital member, we will send you the rather amazing Timber Bell. We are massive fans of this bell, as it can be locked off or turned on. This small cowbell will gently alert other trail users as you approach. Whilst this is great for trail harmony, it is also brilliant at keeping the trail clear and your speed up. The Timber Bell is worth £27.99, and it's free with an annual print membership at £39, but also the digital membership at only £20. Yes, £20 gets you a year of digital membership and a £27.99 bell. Simply use the special offer code FREEBELL04 at checkout. And then he's got brackets, and T's and C's cannot be used in conjunction with any other offers and that sort of stuff. So there we go. That's the promo for this week. Get in there. The other really important thing is there's another cutoff date of the 25th of November. That is the date that we process all of the live subscriptions and send them through to our mailing house. So that means that if you join us after the 25th, you're not going to get the next issue. And the next issue is well worth getting. Because, Chips, it's not just a magazine, this issue, is it? There's something else with it.
There is the traditional single-track calendar.
Absolutely. How's that looking, Amanda?
You can't see the panic. Don't remind me now that I need to make the calendar.
You haven't forgotten it, have you?
No, definitely not. I've done the important bit, which is making sure all the photos are brilliant, which I did with Ross. Ross has input. Calendar in the bag, definitely already finished that.
I think the most important point of creating one of these calendars that you hang on the wall is to make sure that the hole goes in the right place. Isn't that right, Chips?
Yes. Another British mountain bike magazine did famously come out with the hole of their calendar, sheet-based calendar, on the wrong side so that you could hang it up, but you couldn't actually open it.
It sounds like the sort of thing that we would have probably done, but we've managed to avoid doing that over the years, haven't we?
We've just done other things. We probably haven't got time to go into all of them now, but yes, there have been
That's a good podcast episode, that. We'll go through all the mistakes that we've made.
Oh, yes.
It'll be a very long podcast.
Yeah, we could have special guests. We could have props. We could have...
People with upset with our mistakes.
We'll park that idea. Right. What I want to do now is bring in Anthony. We're going to jump to Anthony now, because in my notes here, and this made Anthony giggle, I've got latest shenanigans from the Scottish Access Forum conference. Is that
The Scottish Mountain Bike Conference. So it's a bit more. It's a bit more than Access. It kind of covers everything. It's like the industry, what's going on with trail sensor developments, what's going on with all sorts of really exciting initiatives in Scotland. And it's every 2 years, and I'm always really excited to go because they're just crushing it in terms of what they're doing for mountain biking up there. They're doing such a brilliant job, and it's a good example for the rest of the UK to look to.
Yeah, I mean, Scotland is killing it and has been killing it for years, hasn't it? As a global sort of mountain bike player, it's often sort of ranked up there with places to ride bikes like, the slightly more famous sort of BC and Canada and places like that. But they've won awards, haven't they? World awards for the Scottish trails, I think.
Yeah, if you were going to go and ride your bike in the UK and you had to choose a country, you would probably have Scotland at the top. Wales second and England at the bottom.
Oh, Chips is raising his hand. I think he's got an objection.
No, I'm not. I'm not disagreeing at all. I was just wondering, because Scotland famously has very liberal access laws where you can basically ride your bike as long as you're not going through someone's garden or across a field full of wheat, you can ride your bike anywhere. So why does it need...
You said field of wheat, not field of weed, right? I don't think they do much of that up there.
Is Scotland known for its fields of wheat?
Well, barley, which is used heavily in the production of whiskey, so they definitely have some of that. So fields of barley, football fields, rugby pitches, and people's gardens. You can ride... just about anywhere else, as long as you're not causing some permanent damage. So why does it need trail associations?
Well, basically, in Scotland, you're right, they have a right of responsible access. And it's actually a little bit more mixed up there than we kind of see from the outside. We go up there, we go riding, we're like, this is fantastic, I'm riding on a footpath, it's brilliant, it should be like this in the rest of the UK. But in the context of riders building trails, which there's been quite a boom in recent years, it's created a bit of an issue, because what happens is rider builds trail, other riders start riding trail, it gets on Trail Forks, Strava, whatever, and then for a landowner to then come along and close that trail and stop people riding on it is quite difficult under the Scottish Outdoor Access Code. You know, putting up fences around land is something that you do in very specific, limited circumstances, and it draws a lot of criticism because they're rightly proud of the right to access up there. So instead, what they're trying to do is work with riders to develop trails in the right place. And sort of go, there's a time and a place for gnarly hand cut stuff, and there needs to be a broader offering in this part of the country to put more stuff in for beginners. And yeah, really a big focus of this conference was what they're doing up in Aberdeenshire at the moment, which has loads of fantastic natural riding. But what they've done over the past few years is teamed up with a local, really proactive trail association. And as well as like local communities in Scotland own forests and things like that. It's a really, you know, it's a really cool setup, someone coming from England. And yeah, the showpiece is a new trail centre that they're currently developing in Aberdeenshire that they've got £1 million of investment for. And it's going to have loads and loads of really fun, flowy trails for all levels, built in a kind of, you know, really attentive, attention to detail sort of the style you'd expect from a rider built trail. So yeah, it's really exciting. They're doing some really amazing stuff up there.
Cool. So is that all sort of, I mean, you've spun that as a really positive thing, but it sort of came out of a sort of an issue, which is that if trails, you can ride anywhere, people are starting to dig trails. And is that actually becoming an issue? Is it problematic?
It's been a massive issue over the past few years. Particularly over lockdown, but even before then, they were having problems with riders building trails in inappropriate places. They were building trails through forests where capercaillie are. There's like 500 breeding pairs of capercaillie in Scotland and things. They had riders building trails that exited onto roads and stuff like that with real sort of pressing safety issues. So yeah, it's an attempt to kind of get the riders on board and get some actual proactive management. I mean, part of the issue is Forest and Land Scotland have a massive landholding. They are the biggest landholder in Scotland. One stat that one of their staff mentioned was that more people visit the Scottish Forest than visit the beach up there, which you can kind of, you know, I totally buy that. And yeah, they are spread very, very thin. And it's just trying to get riders engaged with actually managing this stuff and making them realise that they can actually sort of benefit from doing it as well. It's not just a case of getting them to do all the dirty work.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So, I mean, it's quite clear that Scotland is a, shall we say, a forward-looking kind of place when it comes to mountain biking and access. And by contrast, England, I was going to say the rest of the UK, but not include Wales, because Wales has actually made some changes and some improvements, I guess, to mountain bike access. But England is kind of not on that, in the same ballpark, is it really? Do you think there's any chance of that kind of slightly more liberal attitude of the in Scotland leaking down south into the UK, into England?
Well, I hope against hope that that is what will happen gradually. Unfortunately, it seems like they're kind of responding to the explosion in trail building that's happened over lockdown by taking a bit of a harder line. And they've not really sort of come out and made a formal announcement. But for example, at the conference, we were asked to take part in a couple of workshops on trail development. And one of them asked us to consider a zero tolerance policy to new unauthorized trails. Basically, anything that looks like it's been built where someone stuck a spade in the ground, even if it's just like raking out a berm or something, it looks like going forward they'll be much more inclined to remove that sort of stuff rather than just monitoring it and tolerating it.
Right. So not great news for us down here, for us as southerners.
It's, yeah, I mean, it's understandable in that there's been a lot of unauthorized trail development, and in some areas it's kind of, you know, becoming a real problem just in terms of managing this whole network that's sprung up. You know, some trail centers have way more unauthorized trail around them than there are actual miles of trail in the trail center, and that creates quite a big management headache for a landowner. Like I say, they don't have that many staff on the ground, and they're also in quite an unusual position in that they are a crown body, so they self-insure. So they don't have an insurer underwriting potential liability claims. That all comes out of their operating budget. So it's really interesting. What it's meant that is that in terms of like the really kind of progressive sort of technical side of the sport, think downhill tracks, think like Revolution Bike Park, that sort of thing, it's all taking place on Forestry England, Natural Resources Wales, or Forest and Land Scotland land. So their exposure is massive, but they've got like really robust procedures in place to defend it. But one of the things they have to do is really think carefully about like letting riders have a free hand over where to build. So it does seem like they're taking a harder line.
Interesting. So just to finish off before we move on to something else, you say this event, just remind me what it's called again, Anthony.
The Scottish Mountain Bike Conference.
The Scottish Mountain Bike Conference, right. So, Anthony, just to summarise, the Scottish Mountain Bike Conference happens at every 2 years.
Yeah.
You've been to several?
Been to two now. COVID kind of got in the way of the last one.
So just leaving that conference, how optimistic, because sometimes you can leave these conferences on these issues and feel pretty down and pessimistic about the future. How would you rate on a scale of, say, 1 to 10 of optimism, with 10 is super optimistic? When you how did you feel?
I'd say 7 out of 10, slightly less glowy than I felt at previous conferences, because basically this policy of sort of taking out any unauthorised trail, in some areas of the country, it's really going to stymie any sort of trail development. You know, we're not getting massive grants from the European Union anymore to develop trails in rural areas and stuff. Riders are doing it themselves. And if their trails are just going to get knocked down, then that's going to kind of increase tensions, increase conflict, and kind of drive it all underground and mitigate against the chance of getting this working relationship that's happened so well in Scotland. Mm. And the other issue is if you set up like a trail group, a trail association, you kind of become the mouthpiece or the bridge between riders and landowners. And it can be really difficult. You can sort of end up being backed into a corner trying to explain to the riding community why their trails have been removed and they've only got these boring ones to ride. And then that affects your volunteer base, the amount of enthusiasm and the amount of, you know, it eats a lot of your resources that you could put into developing trails. So, yeah, I think we'll see how it transpires. My feeling is it's a bit of a backward step, albeit one I can kind of understand.
Mm. So it's politics then, right? Shall we leave that alone now and move away from politics?
Enough politics. Yeah, let's talk about riding bikes.
We were so close. We were so close to saying the Brexit word in the middle of that as well. So I'm glad that didn't come out. Just said it.
Yeah.
Right. I'm going to move on now to, because we always, in the podcast, I always want to try and reflect on something that we've published on the website in the last week, just to, you know, as a bit of promo and trying to make sure our listeners all rush off to the website to go and see what good work we've done. This week, Benji published a review, and this got us talking in the office in response to the comments, and it was Benji's review of an e-bike. It was the Trek e-Fuel review. And it very quickly got an awful lot of comments. I think last count is well over 50. And most of them were commenting on the price of that bike. The bike that... In fact, the price of the bike, I'm just going to say it now. When we got that bike, it was about £13,500. By the time Ben reviewed it, it had gone up to £14,500. So in the space of literally, I think we'd had it for less than around about a month, the price had suddenly shot up to £14,500. Is that right, Amanda?
Is that because Benji's ridden it?
Is that now it's worth £14,500? Because yes,
the power that man's got.
Absolutely, who would want that bike after he'd ridden it? Yes, but no, it. I mean, Ben. did start off his feature by saying, ignore the price. And he deliberately set the context of his review saying he wasn't going to comment on things that weren't available in the lower spec bikes. So he ignored all the really top spec gear on it, all the group sets and everything else. He just concentrated mostly on how it handled and its and the motor and how that worked, in order to try and just get away from the fact that the price of the bike was, it's frankly, I mean, we can all agree, astronomical. However, I think that range begins at something around about the £6,000 mark. Now, I am not in any way, shape or form advocating that £6,000 for a bike is cheap, but it's certainly not at the extreme end of that £14,500 mark. However, inevitably, lots of people commented on the price, and it got us all talking in the office. First of all, there's some in response to some of the feedback. I guess the listeners probably probably detected a pattern with our reviews, and I think, Chips, you can answer this one, is that why do we get such massively expensive bikes? Because this model in particular, you've got to imagine that it's not going to be in the middle of the bell curve of where the sales are going to be. It's right at the extreme end. So why do we, as reviewers in a magazine, and it's not just us, it's other magazines, why do we get these really silly expensive bikes?
Well, as someone pointed out in the comments, they said, Johnny Storm says, yeah, it's a daft price, but you aren't supposed to buy it. It's like an S-Works Levo, twice the price of a normal one, just to act as a halo and attract attention. One of the reasons we get such fancy bikes is quite often we get the first production bikes available, and the manufacturer will make those top-end bikes first, in the same way that car manufacturers will have their fully spec'd versions first, because it shows what is available. Those top-end bikes are probably already ordered by their, you know, die-hard customers who want the latest bikes and they want the best bike. So the manufacturer will have a stock of those bikes first of all, and those bikes will be used for promotions. They'll be used as flagship store bikes. They'll be used to send out to magazines. And the reason that we get the fancy bikes is because those bikes are the first ones generally made, and then the lower rungs will sort of trickle out over the next few weeks and months. And quite often they're built in a, you know, they'll be built perhaps in the factory rather than being built by a supplier who builds bikes. And we'll get them because the manufacturer wants us to have the best experience of that bike. They don't want us complaining about, oh, well, the tyres are a bit heavy, or it'd be nice if there was a carbon bar and not an aluminium bar. So we get the...
No one complains about heavy tyres anymore, do they? We've all got our heads around that.
Or OEM tyres made of soap, which we have had. If you pick a bike from the bottom end of the range, which we quite often do, if we can, then that's where compromises are made in the speccing of bikes. And as I think we've said before, it's a bit like speccing a bike at a lower range is mostly done on a spreadsheet. So if you want a more expensive rear derailleur, you have to have cheaper tyres, and there's this sort of balancing. You know, Mark has the analogy of running our website of driving a submarine, where you've got all these dials and things, and you turn one down so you can turn another one up. And it's only once you get sort of into the more expensive bikes that you're no longer constrained by the actual budget. You can be a bit more sort of creative in your spec. And so if you want the same frame to be more racy or more down country or what have you, you've got the freedom to do that because you're no longer limited to the price of tyres and derailleurs. You've got more of an open sort of budget and a freer palette. And so we get these bikes because those are the ones that are made first, then, because they're the ones that show off the bike.
But the comments in there, there's always, and I think it's totally understandable that the readers would make these comments, is that there is a perception, I guess, if we as the media were getting, for those reasons you've just outlined, these super expensive bikes, then there is a danger that the perception of mountain biking is that bikes are really crazy expensive and it's just getting ridiculous. Is that actually the case? Amanda, what do you reckon?
I do think it's not just some bikes that are getting more expensive. All bikes are. But everything is getting more expensive.
Yeah, I think all things are getting more
expensive. I've not put too much thought into this. Well, yeah, I haven't put too much thought into this bike in particular, but on the why do we get the most expensive one, I see it as you can do a thorough review of the top spec and then say, so I did when I reviewed the Wilder, which is the Giuliana's version of the Blur. It had full access, everything on it. And I reviewed it as it was and said, but you could make it more affordable by not having this and this. So we can do it two ways. We could get the base model and say, but it needs a longer dropper and the gearing's a bit cheesy and this and that. Mm. Or start at the top and say, you know, you could sacrifice this and this, but I really think that this component's great. Generally, everything's getting more expensive and you don't need, it's not that we're saying you need the most expensive, it's, you know, within your budget, read the reviews of those bikes.
Yeah.
Because some people can afford that and want to invest in the hobby, you know, life's a bit shit at the minute, and if bikes are the only thing that's good in your life and you've got a load of money, spend it on them. I'd just like to say I'm not one of those people. I've still just got my steel hardtail, but there are people out there that can afford to do it. And
I last year I tested the Specialized S-Works Levo, and it was, I think the retail on that was $13,500. And I rode that on some of my local trails, and I got stopped by somebody at a gate, and he said, oh.
With a knife.
He was also a mountain biker. Okay. He was going the opposite way. But he said, oh, he recognised the bike. And he went, oh, are you from Singletrack? Are you testing that bike? I said, yeah. He says, is that really 13,500? I said, yeah, it is. And I remember him saying, he said, would you have it? And I just said, no, I wouldn't. I'd go all the way down. I'd have the mid-range at 6,000. Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous. We're talking e-bikes here, so just a little context. And I said, I'd have the one that's half the price. It would be just as good for me. And I'd just, you know, if I had 13,000, I'd get the one that's half the price and then spend the rest of it taking it around the world on a holiday and riding it. It's important for us as media, I think, to try and counter that narrative that bikes are ridiculously expensive, because we do have another one in the office at the moment, don't we, Amanda? We've got a Jamis in the office.
Oh, yeah.
You remember?
How much is that one?
It's £1,800.
£1,800, full suspension, really looks really good. And
there's a Vetus Escarp as well, which I've ridden the real base model one of. It was on sale for less than £1,000. And that was an amazing bike for the money. You could like ride anything that you'd ride on a fancy bike on it, because it had really good tyres, basically, and decent brakes and serviceable suspension. And
I think that's the thing. People, as bikes have evolved, I guess, mountain bikes have evolved over the last 20, 30 years, the top end has got higher, but the entry level bikes have got so much better. If you think back to what you would get for, you know, £800 when I was starting out as a mountain biker, you could get a frame for that, or you could get you could get a bike with gears that kind of worked and tires that sort of punctured and a nice rigid fork and steel frame, and it was great for the time. And you look at now, you know, you go on mountain bike rides and no one stops because of a mechanical. I won't say there are no more punctures, but there are fewer punctures. There are fewer instances of chain suck where you have to break the chain to get the chain out from the front derailleur and the frame, and there are just fewer examples of bikes wearing out and breaking on every ride. And we used to stop a couple of times every night ride back in the sort of early 2000s because someone had punctured or someone's, you know, super expensive lights had failed because they only lasted 45 minutes. And now we've got these bikes you can hop on. You don't really have to treat them. You don't have to surgically take them apart and polish and refresh the grease in every component anymore. Entry-level bikes are brilliant. And the level at which you go up is your choice. It's how much you perceive is worth upgrading or getting the next model up. It's the same. Go on.
I'm going to say, I think one of the things that we've moved away from and that might help in sort of the technology point of view and the reliability of the bikes is, I think if we haven't completely moved away, we are well on the way of moving away from the sort of the preoccupation with weight of a bike. I think, Anthony, you said before about tyres, you know, we don't really care about the weight of tyres anymore. We just care that they function properly and they work really, really well. And I've seen some of this feedback from on the forum of people saying, but why does it weigh so much? And I guess our answer in the office is because the weight doesn't really matter that much anymore. It's more about reliability and rideability these days. Is that so, kind of something we can all get behind?
Should we just stop publishing the weight of things? If someone says, what does it weigh? Ask them why. Why?
I don't know. It's an interesting one, isn't it? The whole weight of bikes. It's no longer that. Well, there's a website, couldn't there? I should check on whether it still exists. That would tell us the answer to this. Weight weenies.
Probably still around because some people do care about that kind of stuff. In the same way that some people care about the, you know, the reach to the millimetre and the head angle to the half a degree. And I'm sort of, you know, old school enough that, you know, weight was the thing when all our bikes weighed 30 pounds and they had no suspension. And now they weigh 30 pounds, but they've got all the gears and they've got all the suspension. And you can actually ride them up and down a lot more terrain than you used to be able to the older bikes. But I was having a conversation with Ross in the office, Ross of this parish in the office, who is far more rad and down country than me. And we were talking about the difference between, you know, a Fox 34 and a Fox 36 and Fox 36 and a Fox 38. And Ross was saying, well, the difference between those two models in terms of the benefit you get from steering precision and just sort of ability to smash into rocks, he said, it's a wet shoe. It's, you know, it might be 200 grams. It's the weight of a wet shoe. You know, when did you last sort of stand yourself in your riding gear on the scales and think, have I pared myself and my riding gear down to the absolute minimum to be able to worry about the difference between an XT and an XTR pedal weight? You know, does that really matter? When I interviewed Tracy Mosley once at the end of an enduro race, and I got her to put out all of her backpack contents on a table, and it was quite a big table, and she filled it because she had spare pivots for her bike, and she had a tool and a spare multi-tool in case the first one broke, just because it had to be a reliable setup. But then as she was getting towards the bottom of her bag, she was like, oh, there's a 250 gram bag of fruit and nut that I didn't realize I had. So she was carrying 250 grams worth of unknown snacks that around her for this entire 50k enduro race that she didn't even know she had. And I think a lot of us have made that mistake of going, oh, well, I need a jacket, and oh, I need a gilet too, and then some arm warmers, and I need my tool, and I need a pump, and I need a CO2 in case that doesn't work, and then I need a spare CO2, and I need, and then you've got, you know, an 8 kilo rucksack, and you're worrying about your 1200 gram tyres.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, Amanda?
Can I just add my version of Tracy Mosley's fruit and nut? I did the Curatree 10 with a backpack on just so I could have a hydration pack, but I didn't check through it. And I'd found some nice rocks when I was in the Isle of Man. And there is a picture of me looking at these rocks in disbelief because I'd pedalled them around for 10 hours. They're not big. You know, they were the size of a rock that you'd want to paint.
Did you podium in that event?
Yeah.
You did?
Yeah.
Were you first?
I can't remember what year this was. No, I think I was second this one. Yeah, I came. So the first year I did it, I was on the top spec Santa Cruz Blur. And the second year I was on a Vitus Rapide that is £3,000+.
With a bag full of rocks.
And I had a way better time on it. And I carried some rocks around.
Yeah, you think the suspension was all planted and supple.
Yeah, I mean, Chris Porter's straps led to the down tubes of his bikes to make them descend better. Maybe that's what you were doing with your rocks. I think also when you kind of laser in on one thing, like value as the sole good measure of what a bike is, then you lose a lot of other stuff as well. It's like the biggest how much response I've had recently was a review of a Santa Cruz, which was, yeah, it was a hard value proposition as a bike. But also, if you look at Santa Cruz as a company, they do a lot of stuff around trail advocacy, that again, and things like, you know, lifetime warranties on their bikes. They're just generally a brand that really look after their riders and things. And if you buy a really kind of like, how have they done that for how much money, direct sales type bike, you may not get that same level of support or peace of mind as well. So there's more to life than just a race to the bottom, basically.
Yeah. There's a bit of the buy cheap, buy twice, something like that. There is a term for it, but I think a lot of people don't consider with something like Santa Cruz how long it's going to last them. And also, if you do manage to get one to the point of needing to, say, change the frame bearings, it's actually a nice job to do on those. You don't dread working on a Santa Cruz. So the price it's not so black and white. It's the, you know, the amount of engineering that's gone into.
Yeah. I mean, in reality, most Santa Cruz owners don't buy just one Santa Cruz and stop there, do they?
But it's like, no, there's a reason they stick with them.
Are you stereotyping Santa Cruz owners there, Anthony?
I'm observation-based facts.
So, Chip, you know, that's the famous Keith Bontrager, cheap, light, strong, pick any two. Does that still apply?
I'm just trying to work out now. and we're talking bikes, not kind of cheese or anything.
I don't know. Does it apply to cheese? I guess it does, doesn't it? Cheap, light, strong.
Heavy cheese? I don't know. Anyway.
A lot of cheaper bikes are kind of a bit lighter than their more expensive counterparts because they'll have like 32mm forks instead of 36 ones, that sort of thing. Mm.
Yeah, it isn't just about the spec on paper. I think there, where possible, the bikes are designed as a whole, with quite often they'll use the same frame. But you know, as I said, there's room to take them more lighter cross country, heavier downhill. You can have a more expensive enduro version of the same bike, and it'll be heavier because there's a different use going on. But going back to your question, I really don't know anymore. I'm going to have to start looking at everything coming out, going, oh well, you know.
Oh, maybe there's an editorial there for you, Chips.
Yeah, and the good thing is that it's rare to see things fail these days, which is very reassuring. It did used to be that by the side of every mountain bike race you went to in the late 90s, there would be, you know, a crying man with a broken bike, or a crank stuck in his calf muscle, or you know, folded wheels. There aren't really that, you know, there's not that trail of devastation that you used to get at races. And certainly a lot of riders, you know, can ride out whatever, you know, damage they've got. It is rare to see things that snap in half without severe provocation. So I think from that point of view, we've moved on really, you know, great deal in that. And that's all built into that, you know, the weight and the expense of modern bikes. You know, there were all sorts of kind of not quite cowboy, but sort of blue sky thought, innovative approaches to frame design and, you know, material use in the old days. And that is now a lot more scientific. Even, you know, going down to the cheaper models. And going back to Keith Bontrager, I was riding with him once, and he had the sort of bog standard, you know, chunky aluminium stem and chunky aluminium bars. When Trek had just come out with a carbon fiber bar and a carbon fiber stem with his name on, and I'm sure he could probably get one if he asked nicely. And I said, well, why aren't you riding the super cool carbon fiber stuff? And he said, well, the thing is, we'll sell 50 of those, but we'll sell 2 million bikes with this handlebar and stem on. If that stem snaps, then that's a big problem that we'll need, you know, will cause the company all sorts of heartache. Whereas the sort of super high-end stuff that's, you know, it's all been tested and it's all strong and that'll be fine, but we're really not going to sell many of those. The thing that needs day-to-day testing is the cheap stuff, because that's the thing that you'll get the biggest number of inexperienced riders on, who are going to, you know, drop their bikes, fall off, crash. They're not just clipping in, racing for 4 hours and then unclipping and then putting their bike back in the humidor. They're going to be leaving the bike outside. They're going to be riding to the shops with stuff on the handlebars. That's where you want the reliability. And that's the most important place for a company to have that reliability story. And so that's why cheaper bikes are so much better now, because they have to be, because they just sell in far bigger numbers.
Yeah, I think that rounds it all up very nicely. I think what have we solved here? We've explained why we get really silly expensive bikes. I think we need to probably as media try to make sure that we don't reinforce the perception that bikes are really stupidly expensive all the time. It's difficult because that's what the manufacturers send us, and often we don't have the choice, and we do ask for cheaper bikes quite often, and quite often we're presented with the response of, yeah, well, we don't have any of those in the press fleet, but we've got this really top of the line one that we want to send you. So it's a tricky situation for us to be in, but I hope everybody out there understands that the silly expensive bikes are not always the ones that we seek.
No, we suffer for our art, don't we?
Quite often those expensive bikes, they will be built up quite often by the sort of manufacturer's mechanics in the marketing department to make sure they work perfectly. They get sent to us, we review them. That bike will then get recalled and go to another magazine. Quite often we send bikes between each other at the magazines. And then eventually it'll become either a flagship store demo bike or a roving demo fleet test bike. Whereas the cheaper bikes, the manufacturer's going to basically have to take one off sale, going to have to sort of, it was in the warehouse and it was due to be sent to a bike shop to be sold. And they'll have to take it back so that we can test the bottom end bike or the mid-range bike.
We're keeping the affordable ones available for you.
That's right. That's, see?
That's what I'm hearing.
with suffering. Oh, can you hear the sounds of violins?
We're doing it for you, readers.
Right, well, I think we'll round this episode up there. And so just to finish off before we all say goodbye, I just want to remind everybody about that 25th of November subscription membership cutoff date. And don't forget that the price of membership is increasing for new subscribers from the 30th. So get in before those dates, preferably before the 25th, and then you can get the Christmas issue that has the free calendar. And the last thing I'm going to point out is that if you're listening to this podcast, there is no excuse for you not to also be signed up to our weekly newsletter, which features lots of editorial from the team. It's not just a list of links. There's some really good opinions and stuff that go in there, links to good deals and offers from our merch store. And if you're not getting that in your inbox, then head over to singletrackworld.com/newsletter and get yourself signed up today. So on that note, that's where we'll say goodbye. So it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Him.
It's goodbye from them.
And me.
We've got to work on the sign-off properly. This is pathetic every week, isn't it? Never mind. Right, join us next week, everybody, for another Single Track Podcast. Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye. Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.